So it's my great pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea our good friend, our speaker for the evening, Sam Webster, Ph.D. He is the author of this book that you see here, Tantric Dilemma, has a wonderful. I was writing an email, you know, announcing this event and reflecting on just how creative a career Sam has had. It's something that I admire and extol to people, because I think creativity is something we strongly need in this world today. And so Stuart and I have had the great pleasure of speaking to Sam in our radio show. He has, of course, spoken here once before. Please join me in welcoming Sam Webster, Ph.D.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Wisdom teaches us that before beginning any great or important undertaking, it is worthwhile to invoke the blessings of heaven. The Buddhists teach us to take refuge before getting going. We do the same thing. So I invite you to join me in this. What we do is sound the syllable ah three times. One is to ask for help from all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, gods, spirits, enlightened ones, from the very spirits all around us, all living and such, from the already enlightened nature within each and every one of us, and from the very ground of being, which I see as enlightened inherently, although I don't think we'd get enlightenment. But as it be, we ask for enlightenment from all those sources, and as we sound the syllable ah, they all wake up. And as we sound the syllable ah a second time, they all send back blessing and fill us up with empowerment, strength, light, life, and compost all the negativity and obstructions in our life and experience. And then, having been so empowered, we and they sound ah a third time and bless the whole world and fill it with life and light and all that kind of good stuff. So we think that's a good way to start. So why don't we begin? So three ahs, one to ask for help, one to receive that help, one to share that help. Experimental class rooted in some work that I've been doing for a number of years, but trying to teach in this manner is something a little bit new and different, but appropriate to this venue, because here we sit at a confluence of, well, many rivers, joining East and West as we do. We grow up in Western culture, yet we draw upon Eastern traditions. We enrich our lives with the knowledge and spirituality of the world over. This is what humans do. We learn from each other and go, that would be smart if I did that, and then we go and we do it. This is an example of that. We talk about it as the union of mandala and circle. Mandala. How many people have heard the term before? Let's start there. Oh, good, yes. Great, excellent, that's good. So, mandala, the word itself means circle. It's the Sanskrit term for it. It's usually circular, and it's got squares in it, and sometimes it's divided and filled with colors and laid out sometimes as a painting, as a diagram, sometimes done as sand, but also it is the palace of a deity or the emblem of a goddess or such. All these kinds of things all work out in a traditional Indian Hindu Buddhist mandala. I'm particularly familiar with the Buddhist forms. I have some training in the Buddhist tantras. And specifically, a mandala is the palace of a deity. The main deity or the main deity couple will be in the center, and then all their retinue or different aspects will inhabit all the different rooms, spreading outward from there, and this could be a whole mansion of tearing down with all kinds of other beings who are associated with them, who fulfill their various functions of that particular enlightened form, and how that works itself out in the world. And in initiations, one is said to be initiated into the mandala of that deity, being given some familiarity with it. It's kind of being taken on the, you know, the halfpenny tour. Yes, this is where this is, and this one's red, and this one's green, this one's blue, and all this kind of stuff. They are fantastic works of art, and vitally important in that religious context. It is the graphical element, all too often, because what most religions that involve the senses will do things for to see, to touch, to smell, to taste, and so forth. And this is specifically the graphical element, the visual presentation of that. And it's also often quite geometric, and so an essentialization of the divine essence that's going to be living in there. And with it, it provides, it is a mode of communication, a way of connecting with that essence. And so a practitioner would contemplate it, memorize it, learn it, be able to visualize it, because the very visualization is a conjuring, a calling of that being into presence. And we can also, well, a practitioner might imagine themselves in the center of that mandala as the deity, with all the retinue and all of the accoutrements and appurtenances and all various other such things around that appropriately are about that deity, and themselves in the form of that deity. And so this can become quite rich. It can be simple, a simple one being in a geometrical space. They can also add complexity of great deal of ornamentation, a partner to be in union with, a complicated retinue. It can be any of these things from very simple to very complex. We'll be dealing with the simple end of that today, because it's just easier to work with. So much for the East. The West has something very similar. But in the West it didn't quite work out the same way because of our history. The Western tradition has a thing called the circle. Now, how many of you have cast a circle? Ah, you have a few. Excellent. Good. All right. So casting a circle often involves calling the quarters, addressing the four directions. Well, that's also present in the Buddhist and the Hindu. The older versions of this that we possess were graphical circles that were used with often lettering and diagrammatic dimensions to them, sometimes writing in sacred writing the names and all the different associations of the particular being who's being called. There would be graphical elements within it that might be called a sigil or a seal or a glyph associated with that particular being. Notoriously, these things were in black and white with occasional bits of red. Sometimes they were colored, but they weren't. We don't tend to possess them in that form. There are some possibilities that when they weren't actually used, they were more painted. But in their early forms, they were just a graphic that was looked at, and that's the way we see them. We do know that people dealt with space and got up and moved around and dealt with the four quarters and so forth, but the circles themselves started out as a graphic. And then somebody had the bright idea of actually laying the graphic out on the floor and standing inside it. Now we're starting to sound like the mandala. But the magician, the wizard, the witch, the whoever was doing this, the magic user, the priest person, would stand in the middle of it and have this drawn around the periphery. But actually that was the second phase, because first it was the deity in there. It was the deity or spirit being called. And then, having done that, the practitioner would be in the center, uniting with the deity. But then later we see forms when they're calling a lesser spirit, and the lesser spirit would be on the outside of the circle, in a triangle. So first it was containment and making a good environment, then the practitioner got inside there and participated in that, and that was probably them taking on the essence of that being, and then it became protective about the being who's on the outside, who may or may not have been nice. But that's part of the problem with the West, is that the beings who get things done were not always considered the nice beings, because they were beings of this world, which apparently was bad for some reason. Not being of that particular myth system, that doesn't work away from me, but hey, that's where they go. So, in the West, today in particular, we'd do something where we would establish center and then go around to one direction and do some stuff over here and then go around to the next direction, do it over here, and over here, and over here, and then come back to the middle, do some more hoo-ha, and then say, okay, now we're ready to begin. And that's the common pagan circle casting these days. And we call it calling the quarters, and the things that the four directions would be associated with the four elements. And they often would have deities or other kinds of beings. Sometimes we have sacred animals. Sometimes they're archangels or other kinds of beings. Sometimes they're gods. And they protect us, and they found our space. They make it sacred, those kinds of things. You might be hearing not a whole lot of difference between these two, mandala and circle. No, they really aren't, except that the mandalas are usually dealt with seated. It's in front of you, might be visualizing it, you're doing that. That's very nice. I'm somewhat lanky. Sitting around too long is bad for me. And the Western system does a lot more getting up and prancing around. So when I'm introduced to an Eastern system, such as I'm going to be talking about today, it's like, I can't just leave it alone. But that's also what I do. I espouse a variety, an attitude towards religion that is akin to the open source software movement that happened we're getting about 20 years ago now. The idea that this is all, shall we say, hackable, and as code, as something, if we understand it, we should be able to adjust it and make it work for ourselves as we need to. Historically, we also see that that's actually what is done with ritual and practice, is that when another culture picks it up, it has to adjust it, has to make it work. So this is an example of it. So, how many of you have heard of the five meditation or Dhyani Buddhas? Yeah? Five Buddhas? Okay. All right, great. This is going to be a little bit more on that level then. Wonderful. Let me give you a handout. This is for you to take home and enjoy, and also a point of reference as we're talking, so you don't have to store up so much data in your brain while we're finding our way through this. Okay, so let me start here. Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, moving in the deep course of wisdom, which has gone beyond, clearly saw the emptiness of all the five aggregates, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. O Shariputra, he said, form is none other than emptiness. Emptiness, none other than form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness, exactly form. Sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness are exactly like this. This is the opening of a fairly famous, some people think pretty famous, text called the Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, the essence of it. And the nub of it is this: form is none other than emptiness, emptiness none other than form. And everything ramifies out from that. This is the insight that all of these things that we have here, all of this, arises out of the ground of being, which is inherently empty. And then it returns to that eventually. And so everything that we have is a form of emptiness. And how is that supposed to play out when we're all really attached to it, and it makes us happy or makes us sad, it hurts or it feels good? What are we going to do with all this? Well, this was introduced at a time when Buddhism had gotten pretty deep into its practice, but was only actually getting a few people over the finish line to actual Buddhahood. They may become an arhat, they may become a powerful being, but not quite making it. And so this led to what's called the Mahayana Revolution, when the monasteries basically emptied, and they went out into the world because they developed the concept of what they called bodhicitta, or wisdom attitude, or the idea that if we strive for enlightenment for merely our own sake, it ain't going to go very far. But if we strive for enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, the whole universe gets behind us and pushes. Or at least that's one way to talk about it. The change brought about an attitude towards enlightenment that said, maybe we don't have to take 100 million lifetimes to pull this off. Maybe there's some tech in here that we can improve things. And they were running into the Shaivites, who said, yeah, we can do this in one. And I said, we're going to do this in one. and we're not going to eat any mercury while we're doing it either, which was an argument they had with Anas. So they started absorbing yogic techniques, magical techniques, they might say, and developing a whole other level of Buddhism, which we now call Vajrayana Buddhism, which enlightenment comes in one lifetime.
And about when was that?
We're starting around 200 to 300 AD. This will really get cooking around 700, and then we'll have the great monastic schools of Tibet coming in around 1000 and forward. So I don't know quite the Indian history so well, but there's a chunk of it all going on in there. And of course, then you get the Mongols coming, the Mongol empire, the Mongol Islamic culture sweeping through, and that kind of wiped out Buddhism in India, but it was preserved up in Tibet and such. That's where this really flourished. But it all comes down to this recognition of form and emptiness, and the transformative process in there, transformative possibilities in there. And this turns out to be really useful for us, particularly around the realm of the emotions. And the Buddhists developed this concept of the poisons, which I find to be very handy. Of course, the first of the poisons, the most hardest to get rid of, the most basic of them all, often is badly translated. I'll use the better version of the translation, which people then get upset with me about, but I like it much better because it is sheer stupidity. It's not ignorance. It's not a lack of knowledge. It's not intelligence or not intelligence. It's the dull-wittedness that we get ourselves into, regardless of what we know, how smart we are, or whatever. And that dulls us to what the world really is. And then we get ourselves frustrated because we're not actually handling the world. And then we do something stupid. This is avidya, stupidity, klesha, emotional obscuration, and karma, action. And that's when we screw things up. My favorite image of this is the black fly bouncing its nose off the window. The window's open! You can go right out! Go! Leave! You can't do it. It's like, why can't I get out? This stuff is in my way, I can't see. So it gets pissed off, goes buzzing around, it bites on human, and goes,
yeah.
One dead bug. So that avidya, the stupidity, is not recognizing the glass and going around. The emotional obscuration that comes from that is the being angry. Oh, I want to get out, I want to get out, I want to get out. The karma is then on the basis of that getting pissed off and biting somebody and getting the instant response. They're lucky. They instant karma, it's over quickly, done. On to the next incarnation for that bug. That's a good thing, who knows? But for us, this is where we get into trouble. We don't understand what's really going on around us. We get frustrated. We act out that frustration, and that acting out poisons our lives, which makes us duller, which gets us more pissed off, which leads us into bad decisions again. This gets to be bad. Well, this is the fundamental cause for clutching or suffering and all the difficulties we have in life. Stupidity. That's great, but we need to pull that apart a little bit. That's not quite enough to get a grip on. They got a threefold version. They got a fivefold version, which is the one we're going to be talking about. They got an 18 and a 36-fold version of this, because they're a bunch of scholastics sitting around in the monastery, and they start analyzing things. It gets complicated, but their psychology is a pretty effective one, so it's worth looking at. But we're going to keep it to the fivefold version, because that's easier to handle. And also, there's a great body of practice around it. There's an enormous body of practice around fivefoldedness within Buddhism. In fact, if you poke at anything, you can pretty much find it under covers. And so what you have before you is one of those fivefold sets. And I've given you the Buddhist side of it because this is the part that this is where the data is. And we'll get into the practice very shortly. Now, the fivefold distinction starts off with, of course, stupidity, because that's where it all starts. But then we have things like anger. Let me try to keep to the language we use here. Ah, yes. Anger, arrogance, desire in the bad sense, and jealousy. And these poisons are matched with wisdoms, because each of these poisons are in fact a wisdom, a Buddha power, a way of approaching the world with an enlightened awareness, except we clutched instead. we grasped, we held on to it, rather than just letting it flow. And that's really hard to avoid. We're defending self, we're pissed off, we're clutching that. However, it doesn't have to be that way. And this practice is about using some of the tools of meditation, visualization, and our minds, and our bodies, to get at these points of poison, and to retransform them back into their inherent wisdoms and powers. This is termed self-liberation. In Tibetan, it's called Rongdro, if that is a term that means anything to you. But self-liberation is the usual idea, and it's these poisons liberate themselves when we face them directly and relax, when we let go of the clutching. And to the extent we can let go of the clutching, they will transform right before us. Of course, usually when we're in the middle of these feelings, that's the hardest thing to do, and that's where practices and techniques are useful. And so we use them to help. But I can tell you this much. I was having a really horrific angry fight with my late wife. And somehow in the middle of it, something clicked. And I relaxed. Mind you, none of the energy left. There was an intense radiance pouring through that moment. But in the relaxation arose perspicacity that's helped me see what was going on for her. And out of this rose tremendous compassion, without even the slightest bit of loss of my boundaries, or awareness of what was wrong, or why we were upset, but the anger wasn't there. That just vanished. It was burned away as this deeper awareness arose. And this was one of my early experiences of self-liberation, when it opened itself out. It's kind of like a flower suddenly unfurling in high speed. It's an opening out and a relaxing that's, well, it's a little astonishing when you're on the inside of it and you realize, wait a minute, I was so upset, and now all that energy is still with me. I'm still able to act. I'm still able to see, in fact, more so, because I'm not obscured, and a compassion can arise within that. We got through that one. That was pretty good. But it applies in all the different spaces. And here, when our pride gets grasped, it just becomes arrogance. When our wanting and our appreciation for, ooh, shiny, and we clutch, then the desire becomes poison. When something else over there is happening, we feel bad about it, that jealousy, that envy that comes up, what do we do with it? Well, by acting, by relaxing, it opens out into the power that accomplishes. And so each of these moments of emotional obscuration also is a gift of power, a gift of opportunity, whereby we can transform ourselves and the moment and be in our own enlightened nature. Part of the Vajrayana, or this angle on Buddhism, starts from the idea that we're inherently enlightened, and we've gotten that covered over. And the task is to uncover that and let it come shining out. In Dzogchen, The Great Perfection, which specifically focuses on this, the idea is that our enlightened nature comes scintillating through, comes shining through the cracks in our obscurations in our armor, and our task is to let it shine out more and use that to crack open our armor, break through the shell of obscuration we build around ourselves. And so just by focusing on that, we can just make that work. But the truth is that most of us haven't cultivated enough strength, enough concentration, enough capacity to just do that. So we use other practices like these that we're about to go into to access that, to strengthen us, to develop the capacity to just cut through these obscurations and let forth our enlightened nature. So, question, thought?
Sounds great.
Any questions, comments, cares, concerns at this point?
also, I assume it takes a lot of practice to open to those enlightened natures of ours.
Yes and no. The yes part is, yeah, it takes work. The no part is, once you recognize it, you discover you've already been doing it for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is to learn to recognize it, to, as it were, wake up like lucid dreaming, wake up in the midst of it, and catch yourself being enlightened. And use that to push against the cage we've built for ourselves. And each time we push it a little bit more open, and pieces of it start falling apart. And we can scrape away on it until we thin up the shell, and then eventually it cracks. And then we stay that way. It takes a while, but it could happen in an instant.
Is the assumption that children are born with this enlightenment, and somehow, as one gets older, they lose the ability to just be in their enlightened selves?
Not having raised children, I'm probably not in the best place to actually comment on that. But yes, children seem to sometimes have it, but also are obscured.
But it's not the Buddhist teaching that...
I've never heard them actually say that.
Uh-huh.
It may be in the back of their minds at some level. I think they would say that our inherent Buddha nature is that, and that the child has that. But since the child has already had millions and millions of lives before this, they've had plenty of opportunity to obscure themselves up until this moment.
Right.
They would probably approach it from at least that kind of angle. But in the same way as a child has that degree of innocence, we can recapture that, as that child could hold on to that and maybe break out instantly if their karma is right, if they can work it out. Hard to know. So, we'll start this from the seated place, because it's a little easier to show. But in creating the circle and creating the mandala, there are five Buddhas that go in it. One in the middle, one in each of the four directions. Each of them has a characteristic color, sound, gesture, as well as the character that we've been alluding to, each of these poisons and each of these wisdoms. Now, mind you, when you actually look through Buddhist history at this practice, which shows up, around 400 or 500, and keeps developing on from there, it changes a fair bit. And the explanations for it vary depending on which school and what time period and such, and the benefits and so forth rotate around amongst the various Buddhas. So you'll find various references to this that will very much disagree with this. I'm not actually doing a historical piece today. Therefore, even though I'm a historian, I'm not going to tell you, and this era they did this, and this era they did it. You don't need it. Pick one, learn it. And if you really want to learn about the history of it, it's out there. The West is beginning to unpack all this. The Buddhists basically say, why do you care about that stuff? Here, learn the practice, get to work. When you're a Buddha, you'll have plenty of time to study. Don't worry about it. So, what they would do is they would start with, let me try to remember. Yes, okay. Right, okay. You'll notice towards the bottom of the list, masculine Buddha. These are the various names of the different Buddhas that are in this. So in the center is Vairochana, blue. Gesture is called teaching. And Buddhism has been described as a religion of lists, because it's like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, like this, and here's the five poisons. So, that's the first gesture, counting off the first lesson. So, this is called the teaching gesture. Right. And so, students, item one. So, do that. Now imagine yourself blue. All blue, just like you, just blue. Okay? A radiant, luminous blue like you see at night, just after the sun's gone down, before all the stars have come out, that wonderful, luminous blue. Imagine that you're made of that. Want a little more complexity? A wheel, an eight-spoked wheel. You're seated on it, radiating from your heart, whatever. You can wear it like a hat. The syllable here, the sound, is Om. Om. places in your body. It's at the brow chakra. First one, and that's the one that counters stupidity. So we always start there. The next one deals with, well, there's a variety of orders in which to do this, but we're going to start with the east, which is going to, well, we'll start there because it's the next step. Do I do east? Yes, next. Okay, next on east. Because there's several different ways of doing this and it all spins in my head. Okay, so this is Ashobhya. Ashobhya. The unshakable one. Oh yes, Vairochana means intensely luminescent. So this might be helpful. It's just sheer radiance. Ashobhya is white. Is of the element of water. His emblem is a vajra or dorji. That's the small scepter that you'll see. That sort of dumbbell-shaped object that the lamas or the Buddhas will sometimes carry. His seed syllable is hung, H-U-N-G, but the Indians would pronounce that hum, so take your pick, but the Tibetans all mispronounce things, so there's all these amazing Sanskrit stuff, and then they mispronounce it, and it works anyway. It confuses everybody. But while the core of what Vairochana does in dispelling stupidity, enlightenment itself arises, in Ashobhya, I always see it but never say it, so sorry, it's getting out. What you get out of that is penetrating insight. When we are not clutching, we open out into penetrating insight, but when we're clutching, this is anger. This is sheer wrath, krodha, wrathful anger. So, the gesture for this is touching the earth. That should really be done from here, but it doesn't matter. Touch the earth with your mind. Touch the earth with any of your being. Or, well, let's start there. Now, does anyone know where this gesture comes from in Buddhist mythology? Buddhist, the story of the Buddha. Kind of important, because when the Buddha is sitting under the Bodhi tree, and it is his night, before in dawn he will attain enlightenment, he's being challenged by Mara and this whole horde of beings who are coming and saying, no, just don't do this. It's just, this is not going to be doing any good. And no, there are beings in the world. And just touches the earth as, no, there is need. And the earth responds and defends him. And there are versions of the story where the whole world rides up and defends him against Mara and all the demons that are attacking him and so forth. But this is, here I am, this is my place, this is where I am. And so it is that gesture that we're doing here, touching the earth. This is the place, this is the time, this is now. And it is in that we arrest anger. It's in that stopping and showing up that we actually can then begin to unfold. So here, the gesture. Just let your hand fall off your knee as though you're touching. And the seed syllable here is hung. The color is white. So imagine yourself pure white, like sunlight reflecting off snow. One more time. For this is at the heart. much for anger. It's resultant to clarity when we can unleash this way. But you know, it's all very well and good to get good at this stuff, but it leads to pride and arrogance. But when we stop our arrogance, what happens is the amazing ability to see the good in all, to see everything being the wonderful thing that it is, the amazing value and presence and yet equality that all these different things have. Everything good, everything wonderful. This is part of the power of nobility, the true pride of true rulership, true nobility that pours forth goodness. And the actual power that arises out of that is the enrichment. It enriches all things. It makes everything grow. It makes the rain come. It makes all the good flow. So this is Ratnasambhava, or the gem-born one, who is all wealth and all good, and the color is gold and yellow and earth for the bounty of the earth. And the gesture itself is giving. It's the handout. You know, when it's done, when you see a meditation Buddha and it's a statue, it's often here, but it can be here, just giving. So it's pouring it out. And so I screw myself up. Let's see, yes, okay. So here the seed syllable is Tram, T-R-A-M, Tram. And the color is gold. And its emblem is the gem, the wish-fulfilling gem. That utter piece of beauty. I mean, this is down this road here, you've got a store that sells amazing rocks, that kind of stuff that just pops and makes your eyes just go, oh. So, Tram, find your pride, find your arrogance, find the stuff you're good in, and find your wish to make everything around you grow. Focus there. Sound the syllable Tram. Imagine yourself made of gold, and let that radiate forth. Pour it out. This is at the belly. This is all boys. Yes, you will see her giving this gesture. It's a classic mudra. All these are really standard mudras, and you'll see Kuan Yin or Lakshmi pouring it out. Yeah, this is to give, but that's also, you know, it's like how we give. We pour it out. Okay, might be a little bit personal to cup it, but there we go. This is the way it's done. Okay. So, the next Buddha is the Buddha of Infinite Light, Amitabha. This is desire, but it's also appreciation. While Ratnasambhava teaches the all goodness of things, all same, all lovely and wonderful, all same nature, Amitabha teaches the appreciation of particularity. This thing in its wonderfulness, that thing in its wonderfulness, it's deep appreciation for the particular. So each is balanced, not just all thing good and kind of make everything bland, but here appreciating for each thing having its own unique set of qualities. So we don't lose anything in this. It doesn't all wash away into some gray pablum. It's the particular remains. And here it's red, and here it's passion, and here it's desire. But when this desire is liberated from its clutching, it's the power of magnitude. It's the power of calling. It's the power of drawing to us. And with that comes compassion. Deep, deep-seated compassion. So here, the seed syllable is Hri. And it's done without any extension. It's just the hands drawn in the meditation pose. And from here, from being within ourselves, do we express our greatest desire, our greatest wish for, but we contain it. And so it becomes appreciation, appreciating that which lies before us. And with it comes the power to draw to us all that needs to come. So here, the word is Hri. The color is red. The emblem is the lotus. And it has to do with the genitals, the loins and such. And because there's desire. So, Hri. Get a good aspiration on that H. Get a letter, let it come full force into a good R onto the I. We move from there into the green. And the final of these beings is Amoghasiddhi, by name. His emblem is either a sword, or if we want to be a little less martial, crossed vajra. So that's the vajra of the single variety we had before, now it forms sort of an X. This is green and in the north. This is where jealousy comes up, and envy, and thinking ill of others for what they have. The response to that is action, to do something, the accomplishment of creating for oneself, or creating a different situation. It is all accomplishing. So this also is the power to transmit, to give to others ability and skill. So here, the seed syllable is ah, just that open ah, but it's a little sharper than ah, it's ah, the higher up on the throat, slightly more closed, slight distinction in the vowel, so ah. The gesture is fear not. So, and left, right hand or left hand forward, fear not. This comes from, again, the story of the Buddha, where there was a raging bull elephant charging into a village, and everyone running and screaming, and the Buddha stepped out and said, "Dude, stop." And the elephant went, "Oh, Buddha, how nice," and stopped. Something like that. I don't know if they said those things, but whatever. Anyway, the elephant stopped, and this became fear not. But you also find Kali makes this gesture, Shiva makes this gesture, this is all. And when deities come and they're trying to say, now calm down, I guess this may be a little intense, but just stay with me, fear not. So, green, sword or cross dorji, as you like. This is all right here at the throat, right where you're making the sound. So, that's sort of the introduction. Now, as you'll notice on this list, they all have directions. So, space, blue, Buddha in the center. In the east is white, Ashkobya. In the south, earth, yellow, gold, Ratnasambhava. In the west, Amitabha, and red. In the north, green, Amoghasiddhi. We create this kind of space around us. But Buddhists would sit around. But you can't blame them. You know, there you are in Tibet. It's bloody cold. And you're going to do your dancing under a blanket. In India, they might get up and move around more. We in the West, we definitely get up and move around. So, there's a way of turning this into a circle casting. We get into our space, and first we need to establish center. And one of the reasons why I pointed out where this works out in the body is because then we can do this in the body. So, om. Ah. Hung. Trum. Hri. Om. Ah. Hung. Trum. Hri. Okay? So as you see, do the seed syllables run down through the chakras. This establishes you in your base. So we start here as a foundation. So, and you can match it with the gesture. So, om. Concentrating here. Om. Concentrating here. Ah. Concentrating here. Hum. Concentrating here. Tree. Trum, sorry. Trum. And then concentrating at the belly. Hri. Om. Ah. Hum. Trum. Hri. Om ah hum trum hri. Okay. Om ah hum trum hri. Om ah hum trum hri. Om ah hum trum hri. And you can add the colors, you can add all of this detail. You can put the emblems in each of those places. As much complexity as you like. Indeed. Let me show you a wonderful little diagram here. Sadly, it's relatively small. But if you want complexity, we got complexity. This is the full mandala with consort and emblems and retinue and all this complexity. You can add complexity out the wazoo. Trust me, you can. Every culture gets into this. As far as I can tell, what happens is you get good at it at the simple level, but then the kind of frisson that comes with that starts to fade. And so you add a little more complexity and it comes back. And it becomes kind of an addicted cycle. More complexity, more complexity, more complexity. In the Golodpa tradition, when they have a deity form that they're visualizing, they're putting seed syllables at all the different joints and nadis and all this kind of thing. Massive amounts of complexity. The Nyingma, who don't tend to do the big monastic thing, basically they're householders, they had to go milk the yak, so you got to get your practice done in 20 minutes and then get out there and get the work. So it's different approaches. Complexity can be handy, it can be overbearing. Simplicity can not quite work, but it can also be deeply essential. The trick is to figure out whatever balance is going to work for your lifestyle, for your needs. What does your mind require? Because some people really groove on the complexity. Other people like to relax into simplicity. Different approaches. So, go run the range. You can do this as you like. So, to turn this into a full circle casting. Om. Ah. Hum. Trum. Hri. And then, in the same order, holding the center. Om. Going to the north. Ah. Going to the east. Hum. Going to the south. Trum. Going to the west. Hri. Bring it back. Come to center. Now, if I was doing this, I would probably come to center thus. Well, I'm part of the Western magical tradition, and we have a pair of very powerful gestures that is the last bit of complexity I will give to you today. Because you can do this very simply, just going to the gesture, going to the chords and such. But one of the things that my tradition, which is called the Golden Dawn, teaches is a gesture called the Sign of the Enter and the Sign of Silence. And this is the most powerful single gesture we teach, and therefore we teach it to absolute noobs from the very beginning. It's wonderful. It's great to teach the best at the beginning, and then people eventually figure out how to do this. And it goes something like this, and I'm turning this way so you can see what it looks like in full form. So, what you have is a seed syllable. I'll just use om for the moment. And a gesture. And the gesture is a full body gesture. And it's done. And it's always answered with. So, what I would be doing is,
it would be home from
to get more of my body involved in things, and the sign of the enter can be anything from a to a full-on lunge, as you like it.
Yeah.
And when I'm doing this or any of its forms, it'll depend on the moment and how I'm feeling and how my body is at the moment. You know, if I've beaten up on my body and it's sore, I might not be that extended. If I'm feeling loose and relaxed, I'll push it forward. Sometimes it really needs to all be done here. Sometimes it has to be done with the full body. These are all different ways of applying this kind of methodology, which we pick up from the Buddhists, and yet weave into a manner that's appropriate for us in the West, particularly in the Western esoteric tradition. And this combination I find to be handy and useful.
I have a question.
Please.
To what extent is the empowerment more of a function of just bringing energy into the different articulations as opposed to the absolute color or direction? And I'm asking that partly because I see different systems, particularly circle casting, where the association to the East might be slightly different in one system and in another system. And in practice, it doesn't seem to matter so much because if I'm in one system and just consistent, then it has a certain kind of integrity with it. And then if I switch to another system, I think that's okay too.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to get your sense on how that works for you.
It's a great question and often comes up when dealing with this, especially crossing various different cultural boundaries. There seems to be about 16 ways of arranging the elements in the circle, and I've seen pretty much all of them used at this point. Whether you're talking the Eastern Mediterranean system with air in the east, fire in the south, water in the west, earth in the north, and eventually they figure out about spirit or ether in the center.
Right.
Or, say, the Irish system that puts air in the north, earth in the east, fire in the south, and water in the west. And if you think of it, if you're in Ireland, that kind of fits. You know, in different parts of the world do it differently. In India, earth is in the south, the cold winds are out of the north. I don't know why they put fire in the west, but then they put water in the east, you know, and again, space in the center. All these different approaches, and that's the one that happens to be in this.
Yeah, when we do it here in our in my women's circles, we have the east is fire and the west is water and the north is earth and the south is no south is fire. Sorry.
And air is east.
And west is water.
Yeah. More or less the Mediterranean system,
right,
most of us in the Western tradition use. However, it's, that is also the terrestrial arrangement. Mm-hmm. There's also the celestial arrangement, mm-hmm. which puts fire in the east, water in the north, air in the west, and earth in the south. And that's actually the way the cardinal zodiacal signs arrange themselves in the heavens. Mm-hmm. And that's what that's based on. And so there are then two different layers to the question. One is when you have multiple arrangements within a single system, you might use one, say, for the terrestrial and another for the celestial, and they each have different benefits and different things that you're calling. The Buddhists, I think, make the most useful understanding of this because they're magpies. They will steal from pretty much anybody. If they think it's a useful technique, they'll take it, and they'll do their best to preserve it and not mangle it or try to, in a Procrustean manner, shoehorn it into their system, so to speak. They just absorb it as it is and preserve it that way, and they say, this is method. Truth, you'll when you know truth, you abandon all method. While we're still trying to work our way, you know, you use the boat to get across the river. Once you get across the river, you don't need the boat. So they just refer to it as method, and it has no inherent truth value, but it does work. And so use it to work, and when it's not relevant anymore, put it down. The Western magicians don't tend to go along with that too much. They're looking for the truth, and we got to have the right way. And I really like showing them alternative approaches, and it blows their minds. And it's isn't a win that blows no mind. So that's the challenge before us, is that we have all these rich approaches, and we can either try to turn them into a mash of all the same, or appreciate them for each of their particular values.
It's an interesting point. It reminds me of someone we interviewed on the radio show, a guy named Christopher Harish Wallace, who's a tantric scholar and teacher. And what caught me about him and the reason that we wanted him on the show was that I read an essay of his where he was talking about, in the tantric tradition, that chakra systems are not absolute. Like this, the sevenfold chakra system that's very popular today, that's treated as this kind of scientific truism, was not in the tradition. Was just kind of a later stage that got popularized. But there are different chakra systems, and they tend to be utilized for different purposes. Like there's a five chakra system, yep. A seven chakra system, a multiple chakra system, and it really is a function of the practice, the method, and the intent that you're going after, as to which system you might use. And so there wasn't this absolutism or this kind of scientific or pseudoscientific purity that colors the relationship of the chakra systems today.
We come from a culture that is inherited. We are heirs of a tradition that was extremely orthodox. It strove for that. For 1500 years, Catholicism ruled the West, and being right really mattered, and being wrong was problematic. Most of the rest of the planet didn't do that. So the idea of there being one way that's absolutely correct wouldn't occur to people. It's like, well, over here we do it this way, and over there we do it that way, and we use different means at different times. This wasn't all that exciting, but we have this habit. So when we absorb the chakra systems, this is what we do to it. And so it's really nice to learn a variety of different systems from different traditions, like the Nyingma. We'll often just use Oma Hong, and that's all you really need to get most of the things done. But then they'll throw in Tram and Hri and blah, 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 if they need them. Kind of thing.
A comment on the personally, I use music as a means of reminding myself of how that multiple systems can work. If you take an octave, you can write a melody in major, or you can write a melody in minor, or you can use a pentatonic scale, or and in music that's considered just fine. You know, like it isn't that you have to only use use one scout. So I'm just offering that as a metaphor for people. You know, I have found personally very helpful.
Indeed.
They express different things.
Indeed. You know, they are different. They're not all the same.
They are different. You know, yeah. And they can stimulate certain understanding to ways of expression.
Yeah, I've heard they read the Dalai Lama talking about the different cosmologies, and it's like, yeah, we got the Western scientific cosmology, then there's the Vedic cosmology, then there's cosmology that's in the chakras and vara. He starts listing all these, like, we got plenty to choose from. We use them all. Problem? No. Because we just move between them and use them where they fit. The metaphor I end up with, being more mechanical and not really terribly good with music, is like, use the appropriate wrench for the appropriate nut, you know? It's like, it's a different kind of wrench, different tool, works in different ways. So, any further thoughts or questions?
Yeah,
please.
This is kind of an observation, but this was striking me that there are homonyms, right? R-I-T-E and R-I-G-H-T. Mm. And so in English, we want the ritual, the rite, to be correct.
Yeah.
Are in other languages that you may know, are they coupled differently?
Yeah, ritual comes from ri.
From
ri, the Indo-European root syllable ri, which is to flow.
Okay.
And like Heraclitus says with his Greek accent, pantos re, it all flows. Ritual, is a flow pattern. And the West, particularly Northern European Protestants who renounced ritual, from which a huge portion of our Anglo culture comes from, then as anthropologists went to other cultures, and they had lost ritual sensibility. So when they started looking at ritual, mostly they saw the repetition.
Right.
The truth is that no two rituals are ever done twice the same way. But no, it's always done the same way. Both are true, even though they're utterly contradictory. And so when you press the Vedic priests, they say, well, yeah, of course we did it exactly the same way my dad did it, but yeah, okay, the blue flowers didn't bloom this year, so we're using yellow ones. But then they say, no, it's exactly the same thing. Dude, please. You know, it's like, there is a recognition of the temporality and the immediacy of what we did today. And then there's the pattern and the essence of it that we preserve and get right each time. And then you get stuff like a lot of the Tibetan rituals, particularly the big complicated ones that are done in monasteries and such. There is what I like to call the legal disclaimer at the end of the ritual, which is essentially appealing to the deities or the spirits involved, saying, if we had too much of something, please ignore it. If we didn't have enough of it, please fill it in. If we stumbled over the words, please hear them correctly. If we forgot something, just think we did it. And it's this amazing legalistic kind of document that they kind of chant their way through at the end of it, which I can imagine just laughing to themselves, like, okay, yeah, please have forbearance. It's the prayer for forbearance is what it's technically called, because it's like, we're a bunch of humans, we might have gotten it wrong, please don't be upset with us, we're trying to get it right.
So you depend on the morphic field to carry you through if you didn't
something like
exactly
that
right.
And that's where this does work, where there is a thingness to it. There's something about these gestures, these colors, this combination that creates the mandala, creates the configuration of light, power, mind, meaning, body, that has a momentum, a thrust, a transformative dimension to it. And that's what we're actually trying to get at, which is why I started us with the Heart Sutra. Because ultimately it's all about taking our poisons and re-liberating them back into the wisdom powers that they originally were and which we've obscured. And it's up to us to achieve our own enlightenment. We can get all the help we want, but we have to do it and open up and liberate it.
Is the morphic power in part because we're tuning into something that others have participated in, and so there's a energetic field that, you know, we can plug into?
I think that's the case. Theoretically, I can't prove it. Mm-hmm. However, Let me give this as an example. One of the things in the Golden Dawn rituals that we do, it's a lodge-based ritual, so there are 11 officers in this. There's the five up across the east, there's one in the middle, one in the west, one in the north, one in the south, one on the outside, and one on the inside that runs around in circles, literally. So there's 11 of them, trust me. Besides wearing our funny robes and our other various accoutrements, we also imagine ourselves in the form of different Egyptian deities, Golden Dawn style, which is like with very specific colors and so forth. And we're imagining this while we're doing everything else. So it's a fair bit of work that we're doing. But as we're going through the ritual, the person who's leading the ritual will periodically say, okay, everyone refresh your god forms. Which is, you know, that's what they are. They're a form of a deity that we're wearing as an imaginal layer. As that ritual leader, at times, I've been up there doing just that, and I'm holding the visualization of the whole crew in mind, and as they sharpen their visualization, it's like a camera lens coming into focus. It's an astonishing experience of watching one's own mind be changed by the minds of those around who are all focusing on the same set of symbols, and so they all come sharper and more truer into focus. That's that field. And when we're doing initiation, we know we're delivering the energetic benefit of all of that visualization to the one person we're initiating.
Mm-hmm. And where do you do this, usually?
In Oakland.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just south of Lake Mary.
Uh-huh. That's
fine. So this is a tradition that started in 1888, and we preserve it more or less up to today.
Wow.
So... we got a few minutes. Would you like to get up and move around a little?
Get the chairs out of the way.
Oh, good. Thank you. How to get taken back up? Join us out here, Rob. Let's start facing north, and we're going to go through that center gesture a few times just to get comfortable with it, because it's a little bit awkward. So, can we try it? So, let's start with just the seated syllables. Om Mah Om Shram Hari. One more time. Om Mah Om Shram Hri. Let's add the gesture. Om Mah Om Shram Hri. Same for you. Om Beware the vertical column. Beware of your feet. Ground and plant yourself as you do this. So. Om Tramri. Once more. Om Mah Om Shram Hri. Okay, to the north. The seed syllable is Ah, green. The gesture of fear and love. Imagine yourself breathing. Sign of silence, finger to lips. Draw the circle around. Here, the seed syllable is home. The color is white. The gesture is touching the earth.
Oh.
silence is healing. Drawing around himself.
The seed syllable is Trom. The color is gold. The gesture is giving. Giving. Let it pour out. Gold, gold, gold. Sign of silence. Seal it. Around to us.
I see the syllable is free. Color is red. The gesture, truly meditation, and relax.
Puts a lot of force through us, and you can play with that. It's an amazing thing if you know how to move your energy. It's a whole snap and firing of it. It's very, very useful, very effective. But it's really good to seal it. The Golden Dawn will teach that if you do the one, you should always do the other, not immediately. So
I wonder if the police officer who came by as we directed our energy at that one told us.
I thought, uh-oh, somebody called the police officer.
Any other thoughts, comments, questions, cares, or concerns?
Has there been any, I know this is pretty esoteric, but have there been any scientific studies of the hormonal or neurotransmitter changes in bloodstream through this ritual or through any of the postures?
Possibly, I wouldn't know. I know that
they make a great TED talk.
Yeah, indeed. there's been a lot of there's been tests of the Buddhists in their meditation.
Yeah.
They have some pretty amazing experiences. I know of one lama who was hooked up to an EEG, and they put him through his basic paces, and they say, "Okay, now get angry." And he just kind of looked at him funny, like, "Huh?" And one of his students say, "Put on a wrathful Buddha." "Oh, that." And he's like totally calm. He wasn't even showing any of it, but he just visualized himself as a wrathful Buddha, and it all went wild. So that's the kind of stuff that can happen when you get, yes, well, compassion, sometimes saying stop that isn't sufficient. Sometimes you need a clue by four. And the wrathful Buddhas are considered the most compassionate of the Buddhists because they'll get up in your face and let you know that you need to change. So, as a way of using that as a transition, my book.
Good.
This is a book on blending a Western and Eastern technique. I use a method called
Tantra method of invoking a deity, which is where you transform into that deity, but applied it to a relatively new Western deity developed in the tradition called Philema, which is a derivation of the Golden Dawn tradition that I'm a part of, the branch that I'm in, which is roughly Egyptian in its symbolism, but peculiar in that because it's kind of refracted through Victorian understanding, but we've improved upon it. And so, contemplating these methods, I worked with an artist to produce this lovely piece of art that is the cover. And the rest of the text is about ways for Western folk to absorb certain tantric techniques of meditation and practice and deity transformation, like such. And this deity would be considered a mildly wrathful deity. Only mildly. There are far more extremely wrathful deities with lots more flame and violence and so forth, and a lot less symmetry in the art. The less symmetrical it is, you can tell the more wrathful it is, so he's mildly so.
Ah.
So we have a few copies here if you'd like them. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you so much.
So, really in your introduction, we were told you had a PhD. What's it in?
History. I also have a Master's of Divinity. I'm a seminary graduate, but a couple of years ago I just finished up my doctorate in the history of the Western religious tradition called Theurgy, out of which these practices come from in the West. And as far as I can see, Theurgy is developing very similarly to what would become Tantra in India. Actually, it seemed to maybe they had called it by at that point Tantra, and then the West kind of got cut off and Tantra continued to develop. However, because of that, those of us who practice theurgy look at Tantra and go, wait a minute, that's just what we do, but better. And so, give me some of that tech, and that's basically what this book is. The two systems are much more interoperable than most people would think, but we have a fair bit of experience. The order that I'm a part of is now 15 years old, and we have been working with these methods in both an Eastern and Western manner, and they really do work. We have some people who've, shall we say, gone a long ways down the track.
Oh, fascinating.
Huh.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Okay. Oh, I should put out the donation bowl. Always a good thing. And of course, we encourage people to contribute to support our speaker's work. And the books are there, as Sam so nicely mentioned, for your recollection. Thank you all so much for coming.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So since we're pretty much done, let us do the one last practice that is vitally important for